Hello and welcome to another episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies, and ultimately helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. Today we have full house, so all four co-hosts are on board. I'm Jonas, and welcome Manuel, Michi and Alex. Hi everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi guys.
Hello. So February 2025 was again packed with a lot of interesting news. So what will we cover in today's episode is, of course, as always, a quick market update, then go into some crypto news, primarily talk about the Bybit hack, one of the largest hacks in the history of crypto. So what happened, what can maybe be done in the future to prevent such hacks. And we also talk about the meme coin craziness, which again reached another level this month. Then we talk about some interesting earnings by companies like Tether, Coinbase, and Robinhood that we thought are very relevant for you to share with you. And in the end, we also chat about US and EU policy and regulation. We have been lots of interesting updates, be it around stablecoins, but also around central bank digital currencies. But without further ado, let's directly go into the market update.
Yeah, let me do so. Oh boy, what a month. We've seen lots of downward pressure in the market. We've seen presidential meme coins deflate and cause scandals. There was the Bybit hack, the largest hack in the history of crypto. We've seen macro chaos with Trump tariffs and geopolitical uncertainty and unparalleled crypto ETF outflows. And all this downward pressure led to a approximately 25% contraction of crypto market since February 1st and 18% since the Bybit hack on February 21st. So this is a dynamic month. Probably we start with a market update for Bitcoin. Let's focus on the coin first. So Bitcoin has shown significant volatility this month after starting February around 102,000. Actually, quite strong. Bitcoin initially showed strength, but then entered a downward trend, falling significantly all through month from its previous all-time high of around 109,000 that it reached on January 20th. And this correction has intensified all throughout February, eventually reaching a monthly low of 83,000. Yeah, and this represents a decline of approximately 15% since February 1st. When we move on to the Bitcoin ETFs, we are experiencing unprecedented pressure too, with February 25th marking a historic moment in Bitcoin ETFs, as we've seen the largest single day outflow of around 950 million. And this is part of a downward trend with six consecutive days of outflows totaling approximately 2.4 billion this month. Yeah, and looking at individual performers concerning Bitcoin ETFs, Fidelity's FBTC led the exodus in outflows, followed by BlackRock's IBIT, shedding around 165 million. One piece of news that certainly did not help concerning Bitcoin ETFs comes from the National Bank of Canada. The bank, one of the country's largest commercial banks, has expressed its opposition to Bitcoin by acquiring the right to sell a portion of its Bitcoin ETFs. But don't worry, there are also bullish news concerning Bitcoin ETFs that come from Abu Dhabi. Mubadala Investment, which is Abu Dhabi's sovereign wealth fund, has made a landmark $437 million investment in BlackRock's IBIT. This investment marks the first direct Bitcoin ETF investment by a sovereign wealth fund.
So I'm a bit surprised because the fundamentals overall, I feel, are still strong. There was this Bybit hack, but otherwise, I'm not sure what really changed over the last weeks or very few months that would kind of explain a 30% or more than 30% correction from the top. So either it was overvalued at a bit more than 100K and is now fairly priced, or I don't know. The fundamentals are strong, in my opinion.
What changed definitely is Michael's tone and moderation, right? So really representing the bearishness of the market.
More engaged. It definitely doesn't look good for our yearly price predictions at the moment.
Yeah. No, but I mean, look at all the turmoil in the market that is not only driving down crypto markets, right? I mean, there's so much uncertainty, and we've seen a higher correlation to existing tech stocks over the last months of Bitcoin and crypto in general. So Yeah, I think it's just a representation of the chaos that it currently exists in the market, plus then uncertainty due to the hacks and the meme coins, as you said in the beginning, Mishi. So yeah, I think there's just confusion whether you should now really invest in crypto.
And Alex, to your point, if one asset class is not driven by fundamentals, it's crypto, isn't it? I mean, Bitcoin fundamentals haven't changed at all since its inauguration. But if a market is driven by fear and greed, it's crypto. So yeah, that's why the crypto maxis always push for hodling and sats stacking.
But when I say fundamentals, I don't mean that it's only the design of Bitcoin, but also how is the ecosystem developing. Of course, there was this big negative news now around Bybit. But I agree. Bitcoin is probably way more driven by macro than what's actually happening in the Bitcoin industry, meaning how many institutions are entering the space, etc.
But I think this sharp drop really reminds us that also in crypto there are again cycles, right? So when we reached 100, we were all also in our price estimates, you know, bullish and estimating the 200k to fall, right? But there are cycles, as in every other asset market as well. And this is just, I think, what this reminds us about as well.
Yeah, and I feel the more people say it's totally clear that the price goes to 150 or 200k, and everyone feels like that's it's automatically going to happen. That's always the case when it doesn't happen, and of course the voices were very loud that it would happen. In the end, probably not a surprise.
All right, let's move on to the second most dominant crypto asset. By the way, the Bitcoin dominance stayed strong at 60%. ETH dominance remains at about 10%. So now let's look at the ETH coin. So turning to Ethereum, we've seen even more pronounced movements. ETH began February trading above $3,200, but then has experienced an even steeper decline than Bitcoin. The monthly high was around $3,400, while we're now seeing prices around $2,300, which is a monthly and a yearly low approximately. Yeah, and this represents, of course, a more substantial drop of approximately 30% since February 1st compared to Bitcoin. What's particularly interesting is the divergence in performance between Bitcoin and ETH. While both are down, Bitcoin has shown a bit more resilience, maintaining stronger support levels relative to Ethereum. So while both Bitcoin and ETH have seen significant declines, Bitcoin's smaller percentage drops across all metrics and its maintained dominance above 60% suggests continued institutional preference for Bitcoin. At least that's my interpretation. And this preference for Bitcoin comes from its digital store of value use case during market uncertainty, but that's certainly up for debate. And then also looking at ETH ETFs on the Ethereum front, we saw a notable spike in early February with ETH ETFs recording a significant $300 million inflow on February 4th, primarily driven by ETHA's $280 million contribution. However, this momentum hasn't sustained, with recent February weeks showing modest to negative ETH flows. You know, this, I think, institution behavior reflects broader market concerns, particularly around macroeconomic factors that I outlined in the beginning.
Yeah, let's see how the market development turns when there's a little bit more clarity. But I think in general, I mean, maybe a positive market driver. There's never been so much momentum in crypto in comparison to the last years, right? So the crypto Trump administration is very supportive. So let's see where it will take us in the next ones. But overshadowed by this positive or negative or confusing market situation was definitely the crypto hack, and we already introduced it in the beginning. Bybit, one of the largest exchanges on this planet, based here in Asia, has been hacked, and it was the largest hack ever recorded, and likely also the one of the largest heists in the history of humankind, where $1.4 billion were stolen, or better to say, crypto worth $1.4 billion was stolen from this crypto exchange. And Yeah, we brought some information on what exactly happened and want to outline high level what happened and how the whole history unfolded or the whole story unfolded. So it was predominantly ETH or also wrapped ETH, so tokens that are usually issued by other third parties that represent Ethereum. They were stolen from the cold wallet infrastructure of Bybit. And what was quite interesting to see that the hackers very quickly swapped these derivative products of ETH, so these staked ETH or wrapped ETH, quickly into ETH itself, as this coin, the native coin of the Ethereum blockchain, is censorship resistant, and therefore it cannot be controlled or seized or censored, right? When you have a instrument that is issued by a third party, that is indeed possible. So the attackers stole 1.4 billion, transferred basically everything into ETH, and then transferred the funds onto, I think, 52 different wallet addresses. And then all the analytics firms jumped on that case and now presented very insightful reports on what exactly then happened. But it's quite obvious now that the attackers were Lazarus Group, which is an attacker or a hacking group from North Korea, because the same techniques were used also in other attacks that have happened over the last years.
And I remember, Manuel, when there was this hack, I've seen a tweet which was saying North Korea is building up an Ethereum reserve. And I was just seeing this headline and I didn't know where this was coming from. But yeah.
I mean, in the short term, that's likely, right? Because it's definitely going to be challenging to cash out of these ETH, right? So maybe in the short term, it is becoming an ETH reserve. But I suppose they rather interested in liquidating it. And therefore, then there was, you know, some rumors that this was spent for the nuclear project of North Korea and so forth. I mean, 1.4 billion is really a lot of money. So, yeah.
But as of now, how much of that money are still in the hands of the hackers and how much, like, was freezed? I assume they won't be able to anyway kind of get there or keep their hands on the 1.4 billion.
Well, I mean, ETH itself is really hard to freeze, right? I mean, there was
ETH for sure. ETH is hard to freeze, but I mean, if they most likely want to cash out and go back to fiat, and I mean, it's impossible, probably with that amount, to do that via decentralized exchanges only. Yep. And even there, I mean, that's usually where you can get your hands on the stuff, right?
But what they did, Alex, actually, in the meantime, they actually did split this up into, I think, 1,000 or 10,000 different addresses. So they really got the size down, and they at least want to try this via decentralized exchanges. Let's see if they succeed. But I think, Manuel, if I'm not wrong, really just a very, very small amount was frozen already, right?
Yeah, yeah. So a couple of tethers were frozen, a couple of wrapped ETH were frozen. So the ones that are ultimately issued by third parties that control the smart contracts that can then blacklist these addresses. Yeah. But the rest, I mean, they started to launder it via mixing protocols and so forth, also swapping some into Bitcoin now. But in general, I mean, they are under full control of the assets, right?
How did all this happen, Manuel?
Exactly. What happened exactly? So, interestingly enough, the cold wallet infrastructure of Bybit was compromised. And that's quite interesting how they did it. And apparently, this was also done in the past already. So, Bybit used a cold wallet infrastructure, which is recommended, and also multi-sig wallets, where six users ultimately had to sign off. And they compromised at least three of the six users by showcasing in the front end of the Bybit personnel that authorized the transaction a different address to what the cold wallet would ultimately send the crypto to, right? So ultimately, they compromised the front end where the approvers saw the address and then blind, by using a blind signature device, they didn't check again, or it was not possible to check again to which exact wallet and address this crypto is then sent. And therefore, they confirmed the transactions and then the crypto was sent to other addresses which were not shown in the front end, right? So what the hackers ultimately did is they changed the front end. They compromised the computers and the devices of those validators, and then basically, changed the addresses to which the crypto was sent.
Yeah, and Manu, with your so with could your you analysis, say, we already come to the first implication of this whole hack, because it requires a security infrastructure rethink in the market. I think the hack exposed a critical vulnerability in these blind signing processes that you just outlined, which are used by many major institutions. So this isn't just a Bybit problem. It's an industry-wide wake-up call, actually, about cold wallet security assumptions and these blind signing processes.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
And I mean, the infrastructure they used was not their own, right? They're using the Safe Wallet, which is actually one of the most used wallets out there. And the security incidents also didn't happen at Bybit, but at Safe, right? That's at least what I have read yesterday in the afternoon. So today's the 28th, and there was a report published by Bybit, an investigation report, which said that basically what happened was that a malicious JavaScript code was injected to an AWS server or AWS S3 bucket. Not sure what that is. Maybe someone of you knows. So on the cloud infrastructure of the Safe cold wallet provider, so to say, this is where the attack happened, which concerns me even more, to be frank. I was actually hoping at first that it was a Bybit thing, but here, let's say the infrastructure provider was attacked. I'm, of course, not deep enough in there, but that, of course, potentially means that other clients might have been at risk as well. They resolved that issue a couple of minutes later, which is already good news, right? But indeed, concerning that the infrastructure itself was attacked here.
But what I was wondering, maybe just quickly, is if I mean, I'm using a hardware wallet, for example, right? And I authorize a transaction. Of course, I see this in the front end on my computer, but I also have to confirm this on my hardware wallet, right? So couldn't a person have seen it if it just checked the address from the computer versus the cold storage, basically?
And that is what didn't happen, because the cold storage, the cold wallet, did not show that, right? So there are blind signing devices where you cannot display the address to which the cold wallet, the hardware wallet, ultimately sends the crypto to. So you have to rely on the front end. And Alex, as you explained it, I also read that. And this is, I think, also how Safe also communicated it, that the smart contract that Safe provides was ultimately hacked. And a malicious smart contract was included in the transaction, which then ultimately showed the different address, but still sent. So, which ultimately showed the correct address, but still sent a wrong address to the cold storage device. There was a blind signing, and therefore the authorization was approved, and then the transaction was signed, right? And that seems to be somewhat similar to what happened to the attack of WazirX in the past and Radiant Capital, where 230 million and 50 million respectively were stolen by a North Korean hackers, by this Lazarus group. And interestingly enough, I mean, so far, they're linked to thefts totaling around 3 billion. So it's quite a significant sum that they have already hacked. But for comparison, in 2024 alone, this Lazarus group was responsible for $1.34 billion, and now the $1.4 billion come on top, right? So this was a massive hack. In 2024, there were also hacks, but nothing in comparison to this.
Yeah, for me, that opens up the whole debate again on what to do with your crypto, right? In particular, when you have, let's say, considerable crypto holdings. And of course, usually when you ask someone from the crypto space, the usual answer is always, well, take it into self-custody, which I'm not sure if that's the best thing to do, because even though now we see that Bybit has been hacked, I'm not sure whether your private security setup is actually good enough to take a significant amount of crypto into custody, because writing it on a piece of paper and putting it on your desk is not safe. Even if you have a safe at home and put the piece of paper in there, it's not safe, right? So it's a really tricky situation at the moment, because somehow doing it privately has risks. Putting it into even the biggest crypto exchanges has risk. And there are no, let's say, traditional banks yet that offer that service at scale for retail clients. So it's a tricky situation.
Yeah, probably one evaluation criterion or dimension to make exactly that decision is reaction speed. And in that case, Bybit's reaction speed or response time was actually good. So despite, of course, the massive scale of this hack, Bybit's rapid response and rapid securing of bridge loans for 80% of the stolen ETF, at least what I've read, has really helped maintain market stability. And I would argue Bybit as a professional institution reacts faster than we as individuals. We might be on holiday and learn only 2 weeks after we come home that our funds have been stolen, while Bybit really responded quickly. Yeah, this demonstrates how institutional infrastructure has actually matured since earlier major hacks because of the rapid response time.
Yeah, and in general, the crypto community was very supportive. So there was support from other exchanges also providing those loans. And in general, it was a common view that the communication was very, very, very good. So only half an hour after the hack, the CEO went onto a live stream, explained the whole situation, remained very calm, and the markets did not react immediately. Even outflows did not lead to, or yeah, the amount of outflows was controllable for that crypto exchange. And only, I think, 1 or 2 days after, they announced that 100% of the funds are now there, and therefore there's no risk of missing assets in the exchange. Yeah.
Nevertheless, I think this incident will accelerate, again, regulatory discussions around custody, specifically institutional custody requirements and cold wallet security standards, and particularly in Asia. So Manu, you're at the right place at the right time. So please keep an eye on institutional custody requirements and regulatory pressure in Asia.
Will do. We'll try my best. Yeah, this was not the only crazy story in the month of February, but one other theme that emerged was again another meme coin, which is linked to a president. So we've seen the Trump coin, we've seen Melania coin, but then also now there was an Argentinian coin that was somehow linked to the Argentinian president Milei, but also one other coin actually from the Central African Republic. Both tokens crashed very quickly, and especially the Milei sponsored or supported token launch led to huge criticism in the market for meme coins in general, for the industry, that apparently the big thing that crypto is bringing out currently is only those speculative meme coins. But then also internally in Argentina, there's now huge criticism of the president directly. So he's asked to step down. There are also some investigations whether he was bribed, for example. And what's crazy about this situation, that it appears that at least Melania and the Libra token in Argentina were provided by the same projects. Yeah, so it appears that there's a group of people that has direct connections to state presidents and can convince them to support meme coins that are issued on Solana that are then pumped and dumped very, very quickly, where a small group of people actually profited tremendously. And that came out very clear through an interview of Hayden Davis, who's the CEO of Kelsia Ventures, who explained very openly how he, as CEO of that firm, was part of the small team that ran those coin issuances, those token issuances, and how also front-running works in this meme coin industry. And what is front-running? It's basically where insiders, so predominantly the ones that are involved in issuing these tokens, buy large quantities of the tokens after they have been issued, and then sell them to the market at a very high price, and therefore also leading to a collapse of the market capitalization of the price, because there's simply not enough demand to keep up the supply that is pushed into the market. Yeah, and that is clearly illegal. So even though in that YouTube interview, we can put that into the show notes, this young 28-year-old man said that there's no regulation in crypto, and therefore it seemed to be okay to front run meme coins here, the industry was quite clear that also in, let's say, unregulated crypto markets, this is an illegal act, and he might actually fear severe legal consequences for this open explanation of what the team and he individually also has done to Melania and the Libra token. So maybe to run you very quickly through the timeline of this Libra token launch. So it was February 14th, where this token was launched on Meteora, a Solana-based decentralized exchange. And then in the evening, President Milei tweeted about the Libra token and supported it and promoting it as a project to boost the Argentinian economy, and said it would focus on encouraging the growth of the Argentine economy, funding small businesses, Argentinian ventures, etc. And within an hour after that promotion on Twitter or on X, the token market skyrocketed to 4.5 billion after that announcement. But then only 3 hours later, it collapsed by 97%. Yeah. And then Saturday morning, so only maybe 3 hours after the collapse, Milei deleted the tweet, and then only afterwards expressed that he was not aware of the whole project and so forth, right? But that clearly can be seen as a scandal where a president supports a coin or a token, then it collapses, and then deletes that supportive tweet.
And what I really loved was what Milei said: I didn't promote it, I shared it. So if you need excuses for something, you know, you can maybe consider him, because, I mean, for me, it's clearly the same. Like,
and I mean, the consequences were severe. There was real financial impact. So the Argentinian stock market collapsed by 5% on February 17, when this all came out. And an estimated of 40,000 people, local Argentinians, affected, with losses above $4 billion US dollars. There's also insider trading suspicions where 34 individuals allegedly made 124 million just between out of them, which were also involved in the team behind the token launch. And 8 digital wallets only linked to these trading withdrew a combined of 107 million. So they already liquidated their revenues, right? Also, there was investigations now, federal judge investigations on the token launch, and also, of course, Milei's involvement. And it could have quite severe consequences for him as well, because there were some text messages also leaked where this young guy, this Hayden Davis, sent text messages that apparently he has direct contact to the sister of the Argentinian president, sent her some money, and believed that due to that, he has Milei in his hand and that he would do whatever he likes. Yeah, and this clearly could be a corruption case, right? So incredible story that now the liberal Argentinian president is also entrenched and involved in this meme coin frenzy. Yeah, last but not least, I mean, also the Central African Republic issued a meme coin which collapsed immediately. I won't go into detail here. So apparently now nation states also see that as a viable support for the economy, but the market does not believe in it. So let's wrap that up on meme coins from states. And I suggest we move along and talk about more positive things, which are earnings of U.S. companies in the crypto area, and also the updates on the latest U.S. regulations.
Yeah, I mean, the first one actually isn't a U.S. company, Tether, right? But they, of course, have a very U.S.-focused product, namely the biggest U.S. dollar stablecoin, and they announced profits of $13 billion, so $13 billion U.S. dollars for the year 2024, which beats most of the big banks globally, I would say, or at least is among the top banks globally. Maybe important, let's say, side note or piece of information, $5 billion of that $13 billion was due to price appreciation of Bitcoin and gold, since, as you know, as we have discussed here in the past, Tether holds as part of its reserve a quite significant amount of gold and Bitcoin. Tether does now have $144 billion assets in their reserves, while there the market cap, at least at the 31st of December 2024, of course, I'm referring now to the to these earnings. So 144 billion in reserves and 137 billion in outstanding stablecoins, which means a 7 billion excess reserve, which is quite impressive, I have to say. But, and that's now the but, of these 144 billion in reserves, only 118, so 118 billion, are really cash and cash equivalents. And that's, for instance, what would be necessary under, for instance, European regulation, the markets and crypto asset regulation, to actually count as proper reserve. So if we now put a Tether under MiCA, right, it would immediately fail because the reserve would be too small. And what's going to be interesting now is that there is, of course, huge discussions about US stablecoin regulation. And depending on how this will be drafted, this might actually have quite negative effects on Tether and their business model.
And it's also to be seen because, I mean, in Europe, we see that exchanges expel Tether as a asset that can be traded on the platforms, right? If now Tether also does not comply or will not comply to US stablecoin regulation, then I think the pressure on Tether is even increasing more to become compliant to any one of them. Because, I think the US market is big enough for Tether to become compliant. Yeah? So let's see whether the US regulation ultimately gets Tether to comply, because the EU regulation so far did not. It seems that they don't care too much so far, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they're mainly in Asia and the US, to be fair. So it's going to be interesting. When we have always discussed it in the past here and said at some point in time, Tether will have to be regulated, otherwise it can't be successful. So we're getting apparently a bit closer to that. There are now three overall stablecoin bill drafts, two in the House, one in the Senate in the US. So in the Senate, it's called the Genius Act. In the House, it's called the Stable Act. And there is another one in the House, the Waters Bill by Maxine Waters. And basically all three proposals, they're a bit different, but at the end, same from someone who probably looks at it from the outside. They all try to clarify stuff like who is allowed to issue stablecoins. Is it only banks? Can it be non-banks? What kind of license would these non-banks need? Will the regulation be at the federal or at the state level? How has the stablecoin to be backed, of course, that we've just discussed? How quickly do you have to be able to get in and out of the stablecoin, in particular, of course, getting out, so redeem the stablecoin? I think it will be interesting to compare that piece of regulation to MiCA in the end, and then see whether there is some competition and potential regulatory arbitrage that you could do. But in particular for Tether, I think it will be very interesting. For instance, one thing that could be necessary might be that you need to have a US presence and you actually have to sit in the US. And as Jeremy Allaire, the CEO, is pushing for that, of course, because Circle has actually a presence in the US, while Tether sits on one of the islands, I believe. I'm not sure exactly on which one, Cayman or so. So there was a bit of a fight between Allaire and Arduino, the CEO of Tether, about exactly that point, because that would hurt Tether a lot. And it might even hurt the US economy a lot, right? Because Tether is one of the top US treasury holders, so government bond holders. And if they have to liquidate part of that, I think they're among the top, at least top 20, maybe even by now top 10. So somewhere between that. And that would be crazy, right? If they have to liquidate such a huge amount of government bonds. All right, let's move on to Coinbase. Coinbase also announced earnings for 2024. It's interesting to take a closer look at these earnings because you're not only learning about the companies, but also about, let's say, the state of the crypto economy. The total revenue of Coinbase is up by more than 100% to 6.6 billion. Mainly that comes from transaction revenue. So Coinbase mainly earns its money by offering trading of cryptocurrencies, which is probably not a surprise. But they also earn 2.3 billion, so roughly a third, via so-called subscription and service revenues. And this is, for instance, where the stablecoin sits in, right? Coinbase has a nice commercial deal with Circle. The expenses are only up by 30%, which is, of course, always good news, right? More than 100% revenue increase. Only 30% expenses up, which means the net income has actually increased significantly from 95 million in 2023 to now 2.6 billion. in 2024, so 27 times up. And I thought, without going now into a lot of detail, I would just summarize my, let's say, top five learnings from those earnings, which is, number one, not surprisingly, crypto is back, or has been back in 2024. Right, 35% of Coinbase revenues came in Q4, especially driven by the high trading volume. What's also interesting is that 50% of the customers in Q4 were either new customers or were dormant for a very long time. So a lot of new, let's say, business coming in. It's not only existing ones trading more, but also new customers coming in. And yeah, the question is, where's this coming from? Why Q4? And of course, it might be Trump, right? And the Trump news that kicked that off. And one last number I want to share with you that maybe emphasizes or underscores that Trump might have played a role. Very similar numbers for Robinhood, new broker in the US as well. They also, their earnings were up 115% year over year in Q4. And interestingly, they at more than 50% of their revenues or of their, I think it's transaction revenue, came from crypto. So a traditional neo broker, let's say non-crypto neo broker moving into crypto, now earning most of its money with crypto is also crazy.
I mean, we really see how great the business model of exchanges is in bull markets, right? So you said, Alex, what the increase was for Q4, it's crazy. It will be, of course, very interesting to see how this now will change in Q1 again, right? Because now Bitcoin prices went down 20-30%. You know, interest seems to have gone down again, right? So it's always a lagged indicator. But still, for this quarter, it's impressive. And I really like to see, or for me, it was interesting to see, Alex, the 50% customers that were either new or dormant, because I often thought retail is not there. They didn't really react to this, you know, 100K all-time high. But in this number, this, you know, shows a little bit of a different picture.
And probably one very important driver here was just regulation. We already talked a bit about it, the stablecoin bill. But more broadly, I mean, and this happened now very recently, a couple of days ago only, the SEC dropped a lot of lawsuits against Coinbase and other crypto players. So some of you might remember it's already 2023. Within a couple of months, the SEC actually handed out lawsuits or filed complaints against Coinbase, OpenSea, Robinhood, Uniswap, and many other crypto players. And now within a couple of days, many of these lawsuits have been dropped. So for instance, against Coinbase, against OpenSea, against Robinhood, against Uniswap. And of course, that also triggers a very bullish momentum for these players. And what I found interesting was that most of the either head of legals or even the CEOs were pretty, let's say, direct towards SEC. And they said, like, these lawsuits should have never been filed. It was the worst thing the SEC could have done. It was unfair. But yeah, definitely good news for the industry.
Yeah, I would say these SEC lawsuit withdrawals, they signal not only, let's say, some new managers in the top ranks, but they signal a fundamental policy reversal or a paradigm shift, if you will. So the US is shifting from enforcement-led, we talked about all these cases, to a growth-led regulatory approach. What's interesting is this focus on stablecoin regulation first. And this stablecoin first regulation approach, for me, suggests some interesting implications or findings. First is, now there is again a priority on dollar dominance in crypto. So the US has appetite again for dollar dominance in crypto. And then if I were a US regulator or a business person in crypto in the US, I would really be concerned about foreign stablecoin competition, especially from Asia, but also from Europe. And this policy shift is really now respecting or taking care of this concern in US crypto. And I would also say that finally, there is now a desire to bring crypto finally under a traditional banking framework in the US. So yeah, I really welcome this stablecoin regulation first approach in the US.
So let me maybe summarize the other four learnings or takeaways and see if any one of you has a comment on them. So first one was crypto is back, right? Trump regulation clarity. And this is what I meant with fundamentals, right? They still look very good. at the beginning of our episode today. So number two, transaction revenue from institutions grow actually stronger than for retail. So it still, I mean, what's important to understand is that the revenues, and I'm now talking about the transaction revenues and not the volume, revenues are mainly driven by retail, right? So Coinbase mainly earns money with providing transactions for retail, but the transaction volume has always been bigger for institutions. It's simply a sign for institutions paying way lower fees for trading. But what's interesting now is that the revenues of the institutional trading has picked up. So Coinbase is apparently able to monetize that a bit better than before. Then a stablecoin deal with Circle, that's my learning number three, is still a money machine for Coinbase. So they are still earning a lot of money with their stablecoin deal. But other, let's say, products or services catch up. So for instance, custody fees, Coinbase One, their prime broker, the base, the layer two. So compared to the last year, these other revenue sources kind of picked up compared to the stablecoin. And then learning number four, altcoin trading is back. So there is a in the numbers, which I actually would advise you to take a look at. It's very easy to consume the earnings report. The other cryptocurrencies make up 43% of the trading, which is up from 35% from last year. Bitcoin is roughly flat at 32%. Ethereum is down to 12% from 20%, and Solana is below 10%. So Coinbase is only reporting the trading of coins above 10%, which is only Bitcoin and Ethereum. And trading volume moved away from Bitcoin and Ethereum into other coins. So altcoin trading was big. And then last but not least, learning number five, Coinbase is a huge player in the crypto industry. Yeah, as of December 2024, they hold $404 billion in total assets on their platform, which is approximately 12% of the total crypto market cap. Right, that's crazy. One institution... Wow. Having 12% of crypto assets in custody. This might change going forward. And that's my last comment on regulation today, because the SEC has also abandoned the staff accounting bulletin rule 121. We've discussed this in the past several times, SAB 121. It has now been replaced by SAB 122. So my new favorite regulation in the US, allowing banks basically to also offer custody services for crypto assets, which should mean that we see more banks entering that space and also offering custody, for instance, for the ETF providers, and might drive down this 12% number from Coinbase. So creating a bit more competition for Coinbase at that front.
I was about to say, this is likely some negative or bearish outlook for Coinbase. Given also, I mean, you said it's a huge player, but it's not of course, it's one of the biggest crypto exchanges, but there are definitely also bigger players. But the custody that Coinbase provides, especially for all the ETFs, is just gigantic, right? So when you look at all the assets under management in these ETFs, the majority, I think, is still with Coinbase. I think that will change.
Yeah. Yep. So a lot of activity in the US, but also Europe is not sleeping when it comes to regulation. Actually, we are still ahead. Still, let's enjoy that. Manu, maybe you can give us a quick rundown of what happened in Europe.
Yeah, so lots of momentum with licenses for MiCA in the first 50 days. So there's nothing short, but plenty of institutions that now received licenses, 10 entities. Across five EU countries, in France, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Malta, and Finland, they received e-money token licenses to issue regulated forms of stablecoins. In total, 15 electronic money tokens by these 10 entities, 10 euro-denominated electronic money tokens, and 5 dollar-denominated electronic money tokens. There's also 11 crypto asset service providers, so CASPs, that received licenses. Just three in EU countries ultimately, so Germany, Netherlands, and Malta. So also external crypto asset service providers receiving European licenses, which now provide trading, exchange, execution, custody, transfers, and more services. Interestingly, there's no authorized issue of an asset reference token so far, and also no entity on the non-compliant entity list so far. So there was, interesting developments. Known names are the banking circle, stable coin. So this is ultimately a stable coin issued by a bank, by a regulated bank. Circle, clearly, crypto.com, also for stable coins. Fiat Republic, Membrane Finance, that was acquired by Paxos. So Paxos now has a MiCA license already. But also, for example, SocGen Forge with their EuroCV stablecoin. And authorized CASP service providers, so crypto asset service providers or virtual asset service providers are Bitpanda, for example, Börse Stuttgart, Digital Custody, Crypto Finance, Crypto.com, MoonPay, and so forth. So congratulations to these licensees, and also a big thank you for Patrick Hansen, who provided that great overview on LinkedIn, which was a good source for us here for this podcast as well. What is also interesting is that some exchanges, as we've already talked about, now really delist non-MiCA compliant stablecoins, right? So Kraken, Bybit, but also Crypto.com made it clear that as from March 31st, those stablecoins cannot be used. And which ones? Predominantly USDT, but also PayPal US dollar, True US dollar, Terra Classic US dollar, but actually also some non-stablecoins. So for example, staked ETH and staked SOL will not be able to be traded on crypto.com any longer. So in case you hold any of these mentioned tokens on these exchanges, make sure you follow the communication of those exchanges and make sure to defund those tokens from these wallets, because some might be transferred into MiCA compliant stablecoins, but others might then be frozen. I don't know exactly what will happen, so make sure you follow the communication closely. That's it from the European regulation front. So I think we can continue with other European topics.
Yes, so staying in Europe, we do see that there are a lot of initiatives now ongoing. Lots of new developments have taken place around the European Central Bank. But again, maybe kind of, you know, reiterating where we started from is we have seen now with the two stablecoin bills, and we discussed this a few minutes before, that the US has understood the importance of US dollar stablecoins and want to push them. So there is this regulatory endeavors going on. But also in addition, President Trump has signed an executive order stressing the importance of stablecoins as part of a broader US crypto strategy. So Trump actually said that he would promote, and I quote here, promote the development and growth of lawful and legitimate dollar-backed stablecoins worldwide. And you can, of course, now ask, you know, what's in for the US and Trump? It's basically strengthening the US dollar position on global blockchain-based use cases, right? So that's why this momentum is taking place. And I really appreciate that the US has understood the potential here, which we have also been discussing for years, actually, in this podcast. And now the ECB is basically reacting to this development that the US pushing US dollar based stable coins. And what basically happened is that ECB board member Piero Cipollone said at a conference in Frankfurt and in Reuters interview that we need a digital euro as a response.
Great,
right?
The US is fostering private innovation, lets the market kind of develop interesting new products, and the European answer is we issue a digital euro. The ECB with its retail CBDC is going to be the competitor to a global US dollar ecosystem.
You got it. That's exactly what it is. But why is Cipollone saying that, or what is he arguing? He's basically concerned about stablecoins as global US payment methods, right? So we know stablecoins are another US made payment tool. We know today PayPal, MasterCard, Visa, it's all US dollar dominated, which he says adds urgency to the digital euro project, because these stablecoins are or can be available globally, of course, depending on the regulation, right? But they can swap over to the EU. And Cipollone actually also thinks, and I think that was very interesting, that stablecoins will be used as a means of payment, even if they are not today, which for me was like a wow thing, because I was thinking, if he thinks that, why not rather pushing euro stablecoins instead of saying the US is doing stablecoins, we are doing something else. But that's what he thinks. And
or both, right? I mean, it's totally fair that the ECB says we are kind of pushing ahead with our digital euro project, but like framing this as our European answer to US dollar stablecoins is really weird. And why not also supporting the European stablecoin framework? We have, I wouldn't say great regulation, but we do have regulation in Europe now, which gives us a head start. I mean, I would have a couple of ideas how the ECB could support the European stablecoin framework, right? For instance, granting access of stablecoin for stablecoin issuers to their balance sheet. Allow stablecoin issuers to back their stablecoin with euro reserves at the ECB. This would be a total game changer and would put euro stablecoins back on the map immediately. So there are definitely things that the ECB could do to, while pushing their digital euro project ahead, also supporting European stablecoin.
But I mean, while agreeing to what you guys said, that it's a bit strange to compare a digital euro project to open permissionless stablecoins, it's also somewhat bullish for this new asset class, right? Because the acknowledgement by ECB representatives, senior representatives, we see this throughout the industry now, right? So bank CEOs have come out and say, we expect stablecoin usage and uptake. I think the Fed also announced that they are expecting that stablecoin usage also in the real economy will take up. So that's all quite bullish that now central banks even recognize this as a new monetary asset and a unit of or means of payment, right? So yeah, that's the reality where we now are in as well, right? Where that is recognized.
Absolutely. And I think there is, I mean, if you look at CBDCs and stablecoins, like the digital euro and these stablecoins, there is definitely overlap. So are stablecoins about geopolitics? Yes. Is one of the key drivers for the digital euro geopolitics? Yes, right? A payment system that is independent of the US. So I do see why, you know, Cipollone says there is a connection. And also I do agree there is some connection, but it's not the whole picture, because where I, you know, a little bit disagree is also the different use cases, as you also started to attack on, Manuel, right? Is for stablecoins, it's currently cheap global cross-currency payments and settlement asset for all kind of blockchain-based use cases. So P2B, P2P, B2B, B2C, C2B. So all kind of stuff, basically. And currently in the design for the digital euro, it's basically cheap and independent euro-based payments, P2P, and also then customer to business, C2B, right? So it's not the same use case spectrum. And I think that a response actually would be a good response, would be a mix of really well thought through retail CBDC initiatives, then also wholesale. We'll talk about this in a second. And also, as Alex said, you know, promoting this stablecoin thingy, right? I mean, it doesn't need to say that the ECB says, you know, this is the way we stop all projects, but at least acknowledging that we do have a regulation, actually a pretty good regulation in place, which can again help the European or the status of the euro, right? So we can turn this around. The US is saying we can push US dollar dominance here, but Europe could also say we could, you know, push the EU situation in this currency market via stablecoins as well.
So Jonas, what you're saying is that EU's two-track response falls short in that it doesn't address core stablecoin use cases that you outlined, like global cross-currency payments, DeFi or blockchain settlement, B2B transactions. So did I get that wrong, that these are the limitations, in your opinion, in the EU response with its digital euro?
I would say, you know, this is one part, but I'm not saying the digital euro should address all of them, because it's, you know, a lot of different focus areas. But I would say a good mix of a well thought through retail CBDC, wholesale CBDC, and some like endorsement or acknowledgement of stablecoins, that at least for me personally would be a good response to satisfy all these use cases with basic European means of payments, which is, you know, what the ECB ultimately, I think, wants at the end.
Yeah, so I would say the concerns about US stablecoins in Europe are valid, but the current digital euro design isn't the complete answer. The wholesale DLT initiative makes more immediate sense to me. It addresses clear market demand and maintains EU financial sovereignty. But I agree with you that it's not the whole answer.
But I mean, let's face it. We in Europe, we have a, you could say we have a problem. I don't think whether it's an active or an immediate problem, but the problem awareness is rising very significantly since the new administration in the US, that our retail payment system is really heavily dependent on non-European actors, right? That's a fact. And I think this is exactly one of the reasons why the ECB is having that digital euro project. Now, what is the digital euro? The digital euro, to me, are two things. First of all, it's access to a central bank liability, so access to the central bank balance sheet for end users in a digital form. But in order to move these new types of money, you clearly also need a payment system, right? And that is, I think, the much more immediate, let's say, threat also from stablecoins, where you would increase the dependency on non-European players for moving money, for doing payments, right? Yes, of course, this is also now in the form of a stablecoin, which is a new form of money. But not sure how quickly that will ultimately be able to be used at the point of interaction. So at stores, also in e-commerce, right? So my hope is that the Digital Euro project now also focuses on what is needed in the medium run or even in the short run. And that is not necessarily access to central bank money that will help to solve this, right? It's rather the pan-European payment system that is required, right? And the Digital Euro project could now really focus on that, maybe even in combination with the private sector, to build out a pan-European payment infrastructure where you could also use existing settlement infrastructure like instant payments that already exist, and not necessarily having to, you know, build the very complex settlement mechanism from scratch that involves this DESP, this DESP, this Digital Euro Service Platform, settlement platform, and access to central bank for every 350 million European citizen. Yeah? Let's see where this takes us.
So what you're actually saying, Manu, is that the ECB should, you know, kind of reconsider to just work on the payment infrastructure and not on another means of payments, right? So that you can rely on existing ones or maybe even establish this, you know, ground rules for the central bank, but not establish a new form of money. This is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, and that could be done maybe quicker, right, than waiting for legislation that allows the ECB to issue central bank money in digital form to everybody and so forth, right? And honestly, I mean, there is no threat to non-government money at the moment. Cash is still used and people use debit cards from their bank accounts in Europe. What is missing is basically a pan-European payment infrastructure at the moment. And yes, you could say there is a need for that, right?
And besides the Digital Euro project, there is, you know, on the retail CBDC side, there is another interesting initiative ongoing I'd like to focus on for the next few minutes, which is on the wholesale side, right? Where the ECB now made a very important announcement, namely intensifying their efforts around settling DLT-based transactions in central bank money, or a little bit more informally, wholesale CBDC, if you will, even if the ECB doesn't like the name for it. And here in particular, the ECB Governing Council decided to expand its initiative to settle transaction recorded on DLT in central bank money. And you remember we discussed about this previous months a lot. There were these ECB trials until November where market participants actually could use such a, you know, form of settlement already for a few months in a pilot mode. And now the ECB aims to expand these initiatives. What does this mean? This does mean that there will be, the ECB announced, an interim solution so that the Eurosystem will develop and implement a platform for settlements in central bank money through an interoperability link with target services. So here it's important that it's focused on this interoperability, right? It's here about this bridge between the existing target system and DLTs, and that the concrete plan will be announced in due course. So at some point in the near future, hopefully, and that there will be a long-term solution, which is the European will look into a more integrated long-term solution for settling DLT-based transactions in central bank money, which also includes international operations such as foreign exchange settlement. So two steps. One, interim solution work will begin ASAP and a roadmap will laid out, and then a long-term solution that there will be, you know, a really integrated platform. I mean, I would interpret this as some form, I don't know, maybe like a, I don't like the word a lot, but a European unified ledger or something in this regard. What do you guys think on this this announcement here by the ECB?
At first, it wasn't clear to me what exactly they mean by now we're going for the target solution. I mean, the type of solution is clear. We had now these three different experiments ongoing, right? It's definitely clear that it won't be the French one because they were basically running the money on a Hyperledger blockchain. But then we had the Bundesbank with their Target 2 solution, where the money was then settled via Target 2. And then we have the Italian way of doing it via TIPS. And Manu told me that also TIPS is actually part of the target services. So the question is, what exactly is the ECB referring to now? Like, which solution are they going to offer, or will it be both? And then, yeah, similar to what you said, Jonas, I wonder what kind of the long-term game is going to be, because there are, of course, also the other at least theoretical setups that the ECB has discussed. So basically the ECB creating its own blockchain where they issue their own money, and they also open up that blockchain for assets, so to say. So the one blockchain rules them all ECB approach. This is called the integrated one.
Integrated.
And then Manu, remind me, what was the third approach?
The distribution approach, where they issue their smart contracts on other external platforms, which could be, for example, some market infrastructure.
And Jonas, I would actually also prefer a fourth approach, and one you have alluded to, like the European Ledger. And I mean, they call this the European Ledger already, but this would be a platform that's basically driven by the ECB, but also regulated financial institutions in Europe. And basically, it's a shared platform where everyone kind of participates. I think this will be at first a permissioned private chain. But at least if everyone agrees that this is the chain and the governance is structured in a way that it's not 100% driven by the ECB, but like a public-private partnership, this could be actually an interesting setup.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I think what's quite remarkable about this announcement is that it came much quicker than the market anticipated, because it was announced that it's more likely that the governing council of the ECB will only decide in the second meeting in May. And now, to me at least, they caught me by surprise that they already announced that in the first meeting of the year. So apparently also the increased pressure to provide a solution in the short term that was articulated very loudly by the market was listened to and heard. And even though it's unclear yet how exactly that solution will look like, the ECB has now clearly stated that they will provide this interoperability solution to existing payment systems, as framed by the target umbrella term, in the short run. So I think that's a very, very positive movement and direction.
Yes, and uncertainty was substantially reduced by announcing this now. Even if the plans are not clear yet, it's just, it's not concrete, but at least you know that the path is exactly this direction. And I also welcome this because the market, demanded that, and the ECB seems to serve that. What I'm still a little bit puzzled about in the end is, how, if there are some thoughts around permissionless public blockchains as well. Because, I mean, Alex, you said it in the end, in the beginning, it will be sure private permissioned one. But I hope that at least at some part of this, it's thought through that you can also, interlink. I mean, it's of course hard to integrate, but don't forget this public permission blockchains. That's exactly what I would say.
I mean, isn't that a perfect bridge? Because looking at the time, I think we need to wrap it up slowly to our findings and our nuggets. Because interestingly enough, Ulrich Binzeil issued a research report exactly on that question, right? So the paper is called Public Crypto Networks as Financial Market Infrastructures, where he and a co-author, a professor of the universities of Columbia's university, have looked into how public permissionless networks could be used for regulated financial market as regulated financial market infrastructures. And there were some unique features that were really praised. So the elimination of traditional intermediaries, universality, flexibility of the base ledger, flattened hierarchy, elimination of expensive, potential error-prone human decision-making, and so forth. And they basically then state these features could allow crypto networks to provide financial market infrastructure with unprecedented efficiency. So very bullish notes here. Of course, they also raised things that need to be overcome. But nevertheless, I think it's quite significant and quite remarkable that Ulrich Binzeil, who was known to shill Bitcoin,
contrary.
The contrary. So provide lots of arguments why Bitcoin is useless.
The opposite of shilling. Yeah, exactly. The opposite of shilling, that's what he does,
Is now really doing like very balanced research into how public permissionless networks could be used, and also expressed that private chains lack many of the benefits that public chains have.
Yeah, thank you, Manu, for your segue into our crypto nuggets section.
I actually wanted to jump on that because my nugget is very similar, or at least related, because it's related to public and private blockchains. And then Ivica Racic, he's the CTO of Swiat, has done a really nice LinkedIn post on the categorization of blockchains. Because I think only saying public and private and then permission and permissionless is actually not sufficient and creates a lot of confusion. Because, I mean, public and private, yes, but then also permissioned and permissionless. Some people use permissioned and permissionless for who is actually allowed to do transactions on that blockchain. But what it actually means is who is allowed to be a validator, right? Is it permissioned, which means only certain parties are allowed to be validators? Is it permissionless? Anyone can be a validator. And public and private is always the question, is it reading rights? Is it viewing rights that are public? So, or private. And Ivica has tried to go a little bit deeper. He has like three categories that allow basically blockchains to be characterized at a bit of a deeper level. So we'll put the link into the show notes and feel free to read through that LinkedIn post.
Great. Thanks, Alex. And maybe, Mike, I go next because mine is also related. Namely, it's another paper by Ulrich Binzai. So, Manu, we didn't, you know, discuss this before, and it's really coincidence. Namely, one on the terminology on digital assets. I think a paper that is heavily demanded, I would say, probably for 5 or 10 years. And we would have avoided a lot of misunderstandings in having this earlier, but it's good to have out because we know the terms cryptocurrencies, stable coins, HOSE, CBDC, you know, always are discussed heavily, and I actually don't like any of those. And Ulrich Binzai provides, together with a co-author, a really good approach on how to frame this accurately. I'm really curious to see if this will change anything in the discussion because the terms are just used everywhere, right? But from an, you know, coming from academia here, I think it's very good to discuss terminology and go back to square one. So I can also highly recommend this, and we link this in the show notes as well.
But what I find so interesting is that he was quite dismissive of many of the definitions, how they are currently used, right? And then also provide some argumentation why it's not correct how it is used. Yeah, very, very strong in some situations, I would say. And maybe for some of the listeners that might not know Ulrich Binzai, I forgot to explain also who he is. He runs the director, or he is director general and runs the area of market infrastructure and payments for the ECB. So he's a very senior member of the ECB.
Who is leaving the ECB soon, right?
Yeah, that's actually also true. Yeah, he's leaving the ECB, yeah, focusing on research more. Yeah.
Starting a Bitcoin.
Thank
heard
you
he
guys
starts
for
a Bitcoin
your nuggets.
Startup soon.
Not. Yeah, thanks for your nuggets. They will serve me well on the weekend. Mine is rather unrelated to yours. I brought a short video called Majorana 1 Explained the Path to a Million Qubits after publishing a study together with a Ferry Cognitive Finance Institute. And after the recent BFRR episode on quantum, I follow the quantum news closely these days, as they do pose at the moment a theoretical threat to crypto assets. And in the short video I brought today, which is by the Microsoft team behind this recent breakthrough in quantum at Microsoft, they introduce this Majorana 1 technology, and they explain again why quantum computing does matter, what qubits, the building blocks of quantum computing, are, how this Majorana 1 chip works, and then the obvious question for our community, what the exact threat or vulnerability in today's crypto assets is. So yeah, enjoy the video. And with that, thank you for listening to the whole February news episode. That was a bunch of news. February 2025 was once again packed with a lot of interesting developments in institutional crypto worldwide. But we at Bitcoin Fiat and Rock and Roll take care of that as we explore the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets, and digital currencies. Thank you to the fellow co-hosts as well. Thank you, Alex, Manu, and Jonas, for your excellent analyses. I enjoyed our full house today. And to our listeners, do not forget to engage on social media, in particular LinkedIn and our Telegram community group. Enjoy our new English language website, and do consider sponsoring, we seek to continuously professionalize this podcast, and partners help a ton in that.
Thanks all.
Thanks everybody for listening.
Looking forward to the next
one. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.